This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And coming up in the second half of today's show, we have some of our Friday favorites. News director Dave Thompson stops by for the week's news. And Matt O'Lean reviews the newest take of a film on a Dickens classic. But joining me now is Kaylee Cannell. She is a marketing specialist with the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation. And she joins me to talk about an upcoming event in Medora. Kaylee, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So coming up, the 11th, 12th, and 13th, there'll be kind of two festivals at once, if you will, both up in the sky, the Kite Festival and the Hot Air Balloon Festival. This is the 18th year of the Hot Air Balloon Festival. Do you know how many balloons and of course, the balloon operators that you'll be expecting?
Yeah, so this year we're going to have 14 balloons up on both the morning of the 12th and 13th, and that's actually the most balloons that have ever flown at once in North Dakota.
Really?
Yeah,
wow,
so
that's
it's
cool.
Going to be the state's biggest festival, which is really exciting.
You know, I know that there's a big one every year in Albuquerque, and I know that this year's got canceled. Do you have a sense of if those might be related? Like, we can't do the Albuquerque one, so we're looking for maybe smaller festivals to do around the country?
So our partner that helped put on the balloon festival is in contact with a lot of balloon pilots that fly around the country. And they're all kind of from that New Mexico area and kind of the Midwest. And so I do think that might have something to do with it, them just bringing more friends up to get the opportunity to fly this summer.
Yeah. Have you had the opportunity to go up in a hot air balloon?
I have not. So I was supposed to go up last year, and then the weather wasn't great. And so that's the key with hot air balloons.
Right.
It can't be too windy, and last year it was rainy. And so we are holding our breath and crossing our fingers that we have some really beautiful weather out here.
Well, these typically get started very early in the morning before the wind has, for want of a better term, woken up for the day, right?
Yes. Yeah. So they will launch at 6:30 both mornings from over by the Medora campground area. And so as long as there's not a ton of wind, as you said, as long as it hasn't woken up yet, we should be good to go.
Yeah. What do those wind speeds need to be? Do you know?
So he said the perfect wind speed is 6 to 8 miles per hour.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's hope so. It's usually pretty calm about that time of day. What do the skies look like when all these balloons are up in the air over the Badlands?
It is just an incredible view, and the sun rises in Medora are beautiful, and so to be able to capture that and then all the colors of the balloons and all the different balloons, and then pairing that with the stories that the pilots tell about why they picked the balloon that they have, it's really fun to get to tie that together and then just see all the colors really brightening up the sky.
Okay, that was a tease. Give me a story. What are some of the stories? Well, I guess I never thought about someone having an affection for one particular balloon over another.
Yeah, so the gentleman that is putting it on is bringing two balloons, and the names are Miss Autumn and Jack-O-Lantern. And so one is a big jack-o'-lantern. Oh, and then the other one is Ted D. Graham, and it's a big bear on the balloon. And so they all name their balloons, and the Ted D. Graham one is kind of fun just because the teddy bear is named after Theodore Roosevelt, and so to see that tie together and have that tie to the Badlands is really cool.
What are the logistics of organizing something like a balloon and kite festival?
So we have really great partners that kind of champion the events for us, and we give them the support where they need. But we have somebody that helps organize all the balloons and the pilots that come. And then we have another lady who helps organize the Kite Fest. And it's kind of, they're groups of people, and they do this in different areas of the Midwest. And so they really know what they're doing. And so we kind of leave it up to them and just help with the logisticals of everything.
I went to the Jamestown Kite Festival this year, and I was blown away by the size, the scope, the intricacies of these kites. This is not something that you can just run to Target and go grab something for 10 bucks. These have moving parts, lots of colors, and of course, they're enormous.
Yes. Yeah. So it's very fun to see that. And they do it, the Kite Fest, up by the Burning Hills Amphitheater. And so it's so gorgeous because you can see the Badlands all around you. And they do encourage people to bring their own kites, which is fun because although there are these big ones up there flying, it's fun to see kids and families having fun with the event as well.
Well, and it's a nice pairing of balloon and kite festival too, because the winds tend to be a little lower in the morning, and then that's good for the balloons. And then later in the day, as the wind picks up, then you just roll right into that kite festival.
Yes, so definitely.
So the kites get going at 10 a.m. on Saturday and Sunday. And 2 p.m. on Friday, and you said the balloons Saturday, Sunday, they get going at 6:30 in the morning. Of course, this is always weather dependent. I'm wondering, Kaylee, too, if you can reflect on Medora 2020, because this is a weird year for any events, and Medora being the biggest attraction, Theodore Roosevelt National Park, and all the fun events in the town. The biggest attraction, tourist attraction in the state. Just briefly, how do you feel about how the 2020 season went?
I feel very good about the 2020 season. I know that that's the general consensus for the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation. And really, when we approached the season, we approached it not with the idea of we need to operate for us, more so though the idea of we need to operate because people are going to need somewhere to come and renew their spirit like Theodore Roosevelt did in the Badlands. And that has been a theme that has really just rang true all summer with people coming and saying this is exactly what they needed, bringing family that they don't necessarily get to spend a lot of time with. And so just getting out in the Badlands exactly like Theodore Roosevelt did and really just renewing themselves and letting the Badlands kind of heal their spirits, which I think is what we all needed a little bit of this year.
Yeah, a little nature therapy. Well, what's that great quote? Do what you have, do what you can with what you have.
Where you are. Yep. That's the kind of overall theme of our show this year. And every year we get employee t-shirts. So that's on our employee t-shirts this year.
Okay.
And that's definitely what we're doing. So
the Kite and Balloon Festival, and again, this is coming up September 11th through the 13th. I imagine it's pretty easy to do some social distancing when you're all outside. But I'm wondering what kinds of protocols did the Medora Foundation and anyone else involved have to work with regarding the musical?
Yeah, so following guidelines set forth from Governor Burgum, we obviously kept more room and space than our amphitheater, so we're only at about half capacity or a little bit less. So taking kind of a checkerboard technique to our seating arrangement, and then telling families that they're welcome to scooch together when they get to the show, just keeping two seats between them and the group beside them. And so it's been working very well. And then one thing that we implemented this year that now just seems like, duh, why haven't we been doing this forever, is releasing people by their rows at the end of the show.
Oh, I do just always wish that was a thing.
Yes, just to, it, like, gets everybody out almost, I would say, faster than how we have done it before. And you get to enjoy sitting in your seats rather than standing on the mezzanine or crowding on the path. And so I think that's something that we'll maybe even look at keeping in the future just because it's been working so well for us this year.
Are you involved with the upcoming Theodore Roosevelt Symposium? It's having to move online this year.
I do not do a lot with the TR Symposium, but Joe Wiegand, our Theater Roosevelt repriser, does quite a bit with that, and he was telling me that it's moving online. And he said it's going to be a little bit different, but if you know Joe, you know that his energy reverberates no matter if he's on a computer, on a phone call, or right in front of you. So.
Yes, I do agree with that. Kaylee Cannell is a marketing specialist with the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation. The upcoming Kite and Hot Air Balloon Festival gets going on Friday, September 11th, and runs through the 13th. You can find the exact times, weather permitting, of course, at medora.com. Kaylee, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Coming up next on Main Street, an ode to the late composer Ennio Morricone.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
KFC has dropped their slogan, Finger Lickin' Good, in the midst of the pandemic, and on last week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Alonzo Bowden wondered why.
They do understand you're licking your own fingers, we would hope. That you don't just, wow, this chicken's so good, I'm just going table to table making friends.
I'm Peter Sagal. You can't catch anything listening to the radio, but we will keep trying. Join us for this week's Wait, Wait from NPR.
Saturday at 10 Central, 9 Mountain.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. You may not know the name Ennio Morricone, but you almost certainly know his work. The late composer gave the world some 400 scores for TV and film, including the theme for The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, widely considered one of the most influential soundtracks of all time. Prairie Public's Matt O'Lean and Scott Previs offer an ode to Morricone.
Ennio Morricone, the uncrowned king of film music. Matt, it is always great to have you on my show.
Thanks for having me, Scott. It's great to be on the show. And he recently passed away, the maestro, as they called him.
Yeah, dead at 91.
Yep. It was a brief illness. He was still composing scores right to the end. I won an Oscar a few years ago for The Hateful Eight, which was not one of my favorite of his scores, but it was sort of one of those sentimental, I think, late career Oscars. But one of my five or ten favorite film composers of all time.
I, for many years, did not like the music of Morricone. And it's until you started talking about doing a program that I got into it. And as I started listening more and researching more, I began to really understand what a brilliant composer he was. And, he was more than putting notes on the page. Everything that he did, as simplistic as it sounded, had a purpose.
He'd put these weird sounds in, Scott. We're going to hear Good, the Bad, and the Ugly first, which is probably his most famous score. But it wasn't just instruments. You would hear whistling. You would hear kind of strange sounds. He was not afraid, as you know, Scott, to put all kinds of very Beatlesque. Remember how the Beatles used to put all kinds of different sounds in records? Yeah. He would love to put sounds that you would hear in nature, like birds or something like that, into a score. And I think it really enhanced kind of that operatic feel that he was known for.
And, you know, I have to thank you for turning me on to his music. In the score that we're about to play for you, there's the famous, or I should say infamous, coyote howl. And I... Whenever I heard that, even when I saw the film, it was like, how stupid. What are we doing? What are we putting a coyote howl in here for? To him, the coyote evokes the violence, the animal violence of the Wild West. And the more I researched him, the more that came to fruition. And I began to understand everything had a place and a purpose in his score. So let's give him a listen to this.
Let's do it.
Go, 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 there go. And we're talking about the music of Ennio Morricone. And I flashed back to the 1960s mm-hmm. when I saw this movie. And I was used to the music of Henry Mancini, of Jerry Goldsmith. And I absolutely hated the score. I remember sitting there, what is this guy doing? I was a music major then. But everything has a purpose. And what I find interesting about this is his use of extraneous sounds, you mm-hmm. know, the coyote howl, the solo chimes, the wood creaks, the tenor guitar. At times he used panpipes, extensive use of trumpet and wordless vocals and whistling and the sound of recorder. It was very unusual, and I think that's what impacted me the most. It was unlike any other film composer.
And also when you hear that score, you just – all of a sudden, the images come to mind. The sweating faces of Eastwood, Lee Van Cleef, and Eli Wallach in that three-way standoff shootout at the end of that movie. It was perfect for that film. So familiar that when people hear that score, they just immediately think spaghetti western, Clint Eastwood, lots of guys sweating, and shootouts.
You know, it's interesting. For as much prominence as they have in the industry, only 8% of his films were the spaghetti westerns. And he found it quite annoying that his audiences related him for these three westerns, sometimes called the Dollars Trilogy. Mm-hmm. But he used themes from Mongolia to America to Schubert and Bach. He kind of did it all. He lived most of his life in Rome, mm-hmm. and so he never spent a great deal of time in America to get used to the American audience. And that is what I think makes him unique.
He was so sought after. The next score we're going to hear is maybe my favorite of his. And this is also kind of a spaghetti western, but it was shot, you know, in the United States with Charles Bronson and Henry Fonda, Once Upon a Time in the West. That opening movement is really evocative of the desert Southwest, and you can just picture the massive close-ups of Fonda and Bronson as they stare each other down at the end of that movie. Great score. I love it.
You know, Matt, for somebody who spent most of his life living in the Eternal City in Rome, he knew musically how to depict the American West pretty well. I mean, better than a lot of American composers.
No question. For many people, he is the composer of Westerns. We don't really know how much time he ever spent out in California or Arizona or anything. I'm sure he had to go to Hollywood at some point to negotiate. But yeah, it's so evocative of what we now think of with those showdowns at the end of these Western movies.
And you know, it's a great example of director and a film composer understanding each other, because you've got Bronson and you've got Fonda, and they are almost wordless at times. He knew to let the music depict what was going on and not the actors. And their facial expressions, the sweat, the heat, you know, you can almost smell the perspiration on on these guys when they do it. A great example of Ennio Morricone using space so effectively in the film, not compacting everything. Mm-hmm.
And then he would pair again with Leone 15 years later for Sergio Leone's mutilated masterpiece, Once Upon a Time in America. If you watch this movie, you need to see the 3.5-hour cut, because it's great. I think it's Leone's best film, Robert De Niro, James Woods. And this score is a little different than what we've been hearing. This score kind of evokes memory, flashbacks. The film is told in flashbacks from De Niro's character. It's a mob movie. It's a gangster movie. And you get that sense of the flashbacks of his life and what's going on with this score. Ennio Morricone's great score from Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in America. That would be the last time he would work with Leone, because Leone died soon after that, prematurely. Ennio would live many more years and produce many more scores.
Morricone's first love was classical music, and to make money, he started to compose background music for radio dramas, and one thing led to another. But you can tell in that score, he is well-versed in orchestration, the voicing of strings. Not only that, but he is so effective at evoking the sense of nostalgia. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just reeks of nostalgia. Now, every film composer is a master of doing that. But that was spectacular.
It was. And his next score, the last one we're going to hear, also evokes a time and a place. And that time and a place is South America in, I believe, the 15 or 1600s. The Mission, 1986, starring Robert De Niro again and Jeremy Irons, and an early performance by Liam Neeson. This is a great film with a great score. And again, this is a big orchestra on this score, Scott, for The Mission. And, of course, it has the famous, is it the pan flute, I believe, we're going to hear? Yeah, that makes this score, as you're going to hear from The Mission.
And he took advantage of the large orchestra, because in the beginning, during the spaghetti westerns, they were on a tight budget, and he didn't have much to work with. So he used what he had very creatively. But what a joyful experience for him to have a modern, large studio orchestra, that budget to work with that, and man, he nails it.
Love that score from The Mission, and you can hear oboes and all kinds of things going on with that great orchestra. And let me say, 1986, when that film came out, Scott, one of the great film years of the 80s, as The Mission, Blue Velvet, Hannah and Her Sisters, Platoon, and Room with a View all battled it out for Best Picture.
When he was recognized as a prominent film composer, and he had the budget to work with, he did not mince on the budget, did he?
No.
Full choirs, full orchestras, added bizarre instrumentation to that. He used it all.
He did.
I'm sure somewhere there was a budget director who was just holding his head, downing aspirins, you know, to look at what that orchestra cost. Complete opposite near the end of his career, or mid part of his career, than the beginning of his career, when he did not have a lot of money.
Well, The Mission was a high-budgeted film. I think it got the cinematography Oscar. It was shot down in South America. He had the budget to work with, for sure, and I think it paid off with a great score.
And I guess we can say in retrospect, it's really too bad that so much attention goes to his early films, which were far different than his later films when he had the budget and the resources. But man, did he rise to the occasion.
He always did. And you never forget a Morricone score, that's for sure.
That was Matt O'Lean and our Scott Prebis, who hosts Prebis on Classics and Prebis on Jazz, with their remembrance of the late Italian film composer Ennio Morricone. Matt will be back in the second half for his weekly movie review, and we'll also have news director Dave Thompson. But now it's time for today's news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. 343 new individuals from 29 North Dakota counties have tested positive for COVID-19, bringing the new statewide positive total to 12,973. These results are from a pool of 6,713 tests for a daily positive rate of 5.09%. To date, 492,770 tests have been administered for COVID-19. 207,756 unique individuals have been tested. There are currently 67 people hospitalized. There have been 590 total hospitalizations since the pandemic began. There have been 10,310 recoveries and 150 deaths. This leaves 2,513 active confirmed cases. Local government boards in Burley and Morton counties could be discussing implementing a mask mandate now that the two counties have seen heightened concerns about the spread of COVID-19. The counties are now in the yellow level, meaning there are recommendations to help slow the spread. They include encouraging mask wearing, possibly limiting seating in restaurants and bars, and limits on social gatherings. Some of the medical professionals on the Burley-Morton COVID-19 task force have recommended mask mandates, saying there is plenty of evidence that mask wearing works to slow the spread. Morton County Commission Chairman Cody Schultz says he will put the item on the commission's agenda, but he says he does have some concerns.
We can mandate it, but if there isn't compliance with actually wearing it, now we've maybe lost some credibility and trust with the public. So we have to make sure that link is strong when we do it. And I think it's incumbent on all of us as elected leaders and leaders in the community to persuade the public that the wearing works.
The task force members all agree that the matter should be talked about by the various governing boards in the cities and counties. And a recent wedding reception in southwestern Minnesota has resulted in 56 confirmed COVID-19 cases. Minnesota state health officials would not say exactly where and when the event took place, but the state infectious disease division director Chris Ersman says 275 people attended the indoor wedding and they didn't wear masks. She also says there appears to be more than the 56 cases, but some who attended have apparently chosen not to get tested to avoid driving up the official infection rate.
People who don't get tested for COVID because they're fearful of the impact for themselves or their school or their community, in reality, are making the problem worse.
Ersman says those who are confirmed to have been infected from that wedding are from 9 different counties. She says they include educators and long-term care workers. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
There's the old teletype machine. It is time to visit with our news director, Dave Thompson. We have him once a week on Main Street to talk about the week's biggest headlines. Dave, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome, Ashley.
So there has been an adjustment in the risk categories across a smattering of counties in the state here. 8 counties now in
right.
a moderate risk, up from low.
Okay, now you look at the counties that are now in the moderate risk. You've got Burley and Morton, and we know that Burley and Morton have seen an increase in cases, especially among the 20 to 29-year-old age group.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have Grand Forks. You've got UND. Students are coming back, and UND has seen some cases go up. UND has had some fraternities and sororities who have had to quarantine, and they're actually keeping students in some hotel rooms off campus, and they're asking people not to leave campus over this Labor Day weekend. So there are a lot of things there that are going on. Stark County is, of course, you've got Dickinson State University there. Barnes County, you've got Valley City State University there. Benson County is one of them also.
Mm-hmm. Does any of this change in risk category assessment, is there any thought behind regulations, you know, like the state of Minnesota has a mask mandate for going into public places? We don't have that in North Dakota. Just wondering if there could be something like that if more counties go up.
There's a possibility of that, but Governor Burgum has always said that he wants it done by people's choice. You choose to wear masks. You choose to protect each other. He doesn't want to mandate anything yet, but still he has the power of the pen to mandate that if things keep going up.
Sure, or possibly even on a county level instead of a state level, because there are some counties that have had zero cases.
Yeah, here's the idea is he wants local leaders to come up with that decision. So if you have it on a county level, it'd be a county commission, or in a city like Valley City or city like Bismarck, it'd be city commission decision.
Okay. I understand that there has been an appointment for the interim state health officer. So we talked about this on Monday.
We certainly did.
At the journalist roundtable discussion that we've had 2 resignations as people are, you know, starting to return to the private sector or whatever their reasons are for leaving that position. So the state is currently looking for an interim and a permanent one.
Right.
Now we have the interim.
Now they have the interim.
Okay.
And that interim will serve until possibly until a permanent replacement is found, because remember the the permanent health officer, Mylon Tufte, left early on in the pandemic back in May or June. Then you had the interim, who replaced her as an interim.
That was Dr. Stahl.
Dr. Stahl left. And now we have another interim director. And from what Governor Burgum said in his briefing, this guy's pretty impressive. So he may stay around for a while.
And who is this? Doctor, is it Mariani?
Dr. Mariani, yes.
Okay.
Very impressive guy.
And do we know, will he be seeking the permanent position? Or
I do not have an idea on that at all. Nobody has said anything about that.
Okay. COVID-19, of course, as we are getting a little bit farther into the school year, is having some impact on schools and their ability to hire substitute teachers.
Interesting story on this, but you know who most substitute teachers are normally teachers who have retired from the classroom, but, you know, they'll jump at a chance to come back in the classroom for a few days to you know, connect with kids because they loved connecting with kids when they were teaching in the classrooms. But because of COVID, they're in the age group that they're risk group, and there's fewer of them who are willing to go back in the classroom. Mm. So there's real concern about that, about what do you do? How do you do that? Because they do need substitute teachers. If a teacher, you know, gets ill or a teacher needs to take a break, you need to have a substitute teacher go in. Now, the Bismarck schools have come up with a plan, and I'm going to be – fleshing this out, they've got teachers that are not necessarily assigned to a classroom but assigned to a school building. So they have a number of, you know, teachers they can call on from a school building, you know, if it's an elementary or a middle school or a high school. That is one way they're kind of working to work through this pandemic. But even in talking to Bismarck Schools, they said, yeah, we're short of this and we need to do something. Now, the Council of School Leaders came up with an idea that maybe you need to just back off for a while, you know, a little temporary back off of some of these standards that you need for these teachers. And you could have people like paraprofessionals who are in the schools actually take a couple of teaching days once in a while.
Okay.
So that's all being discussed and being run through the filters at the state.
Is it fairly equal across the state, or is it somewhat more problematic in the more rural or the more urban areas?
From my gathering information so far, everybody's talking about it.
Okay.
So it is that age group that is the real concern.
I probably know the answer to this, but would this apply to online classes? I imagine they don't have that same issue.
They don't have the same issue in online classes. And, you know, that's interesting. You've got school districts. And I'm glad you brought that up because looking at both Burley and Morton counties this morning, because Burley and Morton counties have gone to the, you know, increased threat level. And they said for the moment they have not backed off what they're doing, which is kind of a hybrid system. And they have people who are able to teach online. And if you're online, that limits your contact with students.
Right.
You know, and there are drawbacks to that. Everybody knows there are drawbacks to that, but hey, it is the hand you've been dealt by the pandemic.
Project Tundra, altering its focus. So set us up with what was the original focus and what are they changing?
Okay, Project Tundra has been a project to capture carbon dioxide from coal-fired power plants. The original plan was to store some of it underground and then use some of it for enhanced oil recovery out in the Bakken and out in the Williston Basin. Well, with the price of oil down, the production has been curtailed a bit, so they're saying the need is not there. So they've asked for a little bit more seed money to look at just how it costs to store the carbon dioxide with the eventual use to have it for enhanced oil recovery.
Okay, so less usage in the immediate future,
more storage.
Okay.
Now, this is interesting because Project Tundra is a $40-plus million project. And it recently became the largest CO2 capture project in the nation because PetroNova, who had one, has basically shut theirs down because all their CO2 is going to go to enhanced oil recovery. Well, they've had to shut that down because there's just not the demand for it right now.
Let's get a quick update on the census. Obviously, COVID postponed the original summertime deadline for this.
Correct. And now by the end of September, they want to wrap things up. And that includes in-person visit when you get a knock on the door from a census worker, mm-hmm. or if you go online and fill out the forms. Well, the census people in North Dakota are encouraging people to fill it out online because they say it's more accurate if you fill it out online than sometimes, you know, you get knocked on a door and you get, you know, bothered. Especially during a time of COVID, you may not want to spend a lot of time with somebody. So it's going to end September. There was a thought about extending it to the end of October, but they just basically said October 1 is the federal new fiscal year. So they said that's what's going to happen.
Do we know how many people have already finished across the state?
Well, so far, 64% have finished the online thing. It's a little bit below the 65% national average. But North Dakota's done pretty well in terms of responding to the knocked doors. And now it's up to about 84-85% of households have been contacted. Okay. And this is very important because census figures drive our federal share of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really important. You know, they're talking about some bridge projects and things like that that have a federal funding component. Well, if North Dakota, you know, shows some good census numbers, the share of the pie gets a little bigger.
Now, typically, Dave, we spend our Friday news discussions looking back on mm-hmm. the week that was, but we want to kind of look ahead at some things that
Correct.
Are coming down the pipeline. A forecast for the legislative biennium.
Right, and the budget section is going to meet in a couple weeks here. And North Dakota's budget director, Joel Morissette, told an interim committee that the plan is to have the first attempt at the forecast presented to the budget section in September. Now, this first budget section helps the governor, you know, come up with some proposals for his executive budget, mm-hmm. which is presented to the legislature in December. So they're looking at that. And Joe Morris had an interesting take on some things, and I was kind of wondering if this was going to be the case. North Dakota, through most of the biennium, was doing very well in terms of tax collections, was way ahead in just about every category. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, COVID hit and it kind of dropped a bit. But still, North Dakota's seeing a little bit above forecast, not necessarily in oil taxes, but a little bit above a forecast. And he said there might be enough cushion that they don't have to do any allotments at the end of the biennium.
Oh.
An allotment is basically an across-the-board cut.
Okay. We have about a minute left here. Any news on what the legislature will be doing when they start meeting in person to be COVID compliant?
It'll be interesting because there's going to be some proposals that are going to be presented to the Legislative Management and Legislative Procedures and Arrangements Committee to see what might happen in terms of how many people might have to be remote, how many days a week do you meet. Are you going to put in some of these things we talked about, you know, limiting the number of bills that can be introduced? I don't think that's going to, you know, sit well with a lot of people, but leadership is saying, hey, we still want to get things done in 80 days if we can.
News director Dave Thompson joins us once a week from our Bismarck studio. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ashley.
Matt Olien is next.
Before I explain the two arguments that I have, I want to see what your initial response is.
Poo-poo to the who's, the Grinch said with a sneer. It's almost Christmas. It's practically here.
In a positive way, it might be someone who is kind of the underdog.
Join us this week on Away With Words.
I have no hair on my tongue, and this is what it is.
That's Away With Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, there's the fanfare. That means it's time to welcome to the studio Matt Olien. He is our resident movie maven, and you're going to talk about the new movie based on a novel by Charles Dickens.
The Personal History of David Copperfield. Now, this is maybe my favorite version of any David Copperfield. The 1935 version with W.C. Fields and some others is kind of the gold standard. This is it's a hilarious movie. I know what you're saying. It takes place in Victorian England, right, when people were starving and in poverty.
Child labor.
Yes, all that fun stuff. But director Armando Iannucci, who is kind of known as a satirist, he kind of combines Dickens with Monty Python with Wes Anderson. So you have these hilarious scenes going on. You feel like you're watching a comedy, but it stays true to the spirit of Dickens. I laughed out loud multiple times just because of the way the beats were edited, mm-hmm, and the way Dev Patel, who plays David Copperfield, is so hilarious with his comic timing. But there's serious parts in it as well. But it has this kind of feel to it, like you're watching kind of a comedy, which also talks about serious issues. The other thing the director did was he cast a diverse cast. So what you see, Ashley, is David Copperfield, played by Dev Patel, who's from India. You have Agnes, who is his love in the film, played by a black actress. You have an Asian person playing a role. You have white people. It's all like this amalgamation of different ethnic backgrounds, but nobody notices. So it's, mm-hmm, filmed as if this is the way it always should have been. No color distinction, no class distinction. Of course, there's class distinction in the film, but it's not based on color. It's based on wealth and upbringing, which was, you know, the big deal class system in Great Britain. So, mm-hmm, that's fascinating. And at first, you're kind of trying to connect the dots, like what this means. And then you just go with it after that. Mm-hmm. And it's totally fine. There's some other comic elements, too, like Micawber, who's a key character in the book, played by Peter Capaldi from Doctor Who fame. He's always trying to escape debtor's prison, if people know the backstory of the Micawber character. But as the film goes on and David ages, Micawber and his wife, they have these kids, and the kids never get older. They're always young, screaming, wanting food. So that's kind of this comic thing that is hilarious throughout the whole film.
I mean, it feels like that from a parenting perspective. Sometimes it feels like they just won't stop screaming and eating.
It's actually hilarious. And Tilda Swinton is in it. She plays his aunt. She's hilarious. She's great in this role. But the real scene stealer is Hugh Laurie, mm-hmm, from House fame, as, mm-hmm, Mr. Dick, who is this kind of crazy inventor. And he is just so funny in this film. I really hope he gets his first ever supporting actor Oscar nomination. I think it's possible. This is one of my favorite movies of the year. It is in theaters now. If you're not comfortable going to theaters, it should be streaming soon. But the makers wanted to get it in theaters, kind of get it out there in kind of the second or third week that theaters are open around the country. Loved it.
It did look very, very charming. And I had a similar thought to what you were saying. I was like, Dickens. I mean, we have the whole word Dickensian, mm-hmm, to sort of talk when something is, you know, depressing. And it's always about social justice. And he was great in bringing those issues to light. But humor and lightness is just not something I associate with the word Dickensian. So
no, there's several hilarious moments, like when David is first in love with Dora, whose father he works for in this law office. And Dora has this little dog, and she talks to David Copperfield, but then she'll put the dog up in front of her face and talk the dog. And then David kind of plays along. He's sitting next to an apple tree. Oh, yes, I'm an apple tree. And you're just rolling in the aisles watching this. I was the only person in the theater rolling in the aisles because I was the only person at the movie. But there's little moments like that that are clearly put in by the director, Armando Iannucci, mm-hmm, that have nothing to do with Dickens, but it makes it funny. But then they always get back to, you know, living in poverty and, mm-hmm, David trying to make something of himself. Ben Whishaw is also very good as the evil Uriah Heep, who's really the evil person in the whole film, who tries, yeah, to, you know, embezzle money from the law firm and whatnot. But this is a brilliant film. I hope it gets some Oscar love in this very strange Oscar year that we're only halfway through right now, because, as you know, even through February, those releases will be eligible for the 2020 Oscars. So we're in a 14-month release time span here that we've never seen before. But I urge people to go see this, and it should be streaming soon. Again, if you'd prefer to wait and not go to the theaters.
Well, it looked like even the costuming and just the color, the actual color tone of the film, and I only saw the trailer, but I was struck immediately by even just the actual colors chosen for the film.
Yes, it's a very bright film. So The only complaints I've seen from some critics is that because it's so colorful, because it's so funny, the kind of poverty and social justice undertones of Dickens are sort of – they're not really on the surface. But those do appear, and I was okay with how they did it because sometimes you do need to breathe new life into an old story.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Oliver Twist was made into a musical that won Best Picture. So there's lots of different ways – to shoot Dickens, and Armando Iannucci has given us a new one.
We do have a remembrance this week. It sounds like we lost an actor far too soon.
I had no idea. He was fighting colon cancer for 4 years, and he apparently shot Black Panther in the last two Avengers films with colon cancer. So what a person to be admired that he fought through that and did his work and didn't make a big deal out of it. And nobody knew. I assume his Marvel friends knew, the actors and actresses.
And we're talking about Chadwick Boseman.
I'm so sorry. Yes. Chadwick Boseman. What a loss. He played Jackie Robinson. He played Thurgood Marshall. But, of course, Black Panther is what he'll always be known for. But what a loss. I mean, what a career that was in front of him. Denzel Washington, you know, famously was really a mentor for him and is very upset by the
paid
past.
Paid his tuition.
Paid his tuition. And really, he was able to portray dignity on the screen in a very charismatic way. And that's not an easy thing to do as an actor. But I love some of his moments in The Last Avengers when Captain America shows up and he says, "Get this man a shield." You know, just little lines like that where he's so good. But what a loss. Very, very tragic news.
We do have an Oscar trivia for this week, and going back to the theme of the film being based on a Charles Dickens novel, what adaptation of A Christmas Carol won an Oscar? It won.
I am going to say Scrooge, the musical in 1970 with Albert Finney, probably music adaptation or something like that?
Nope.
Okay.
Short film. Great. In 19...
Oh, it's a short film.
Yeah. There was an animated version.
Oh, an animated short of a Dickens.
Yeah.
That won an Oscar. Then it's probably... Is it Mickey's Christmas Carol?
No, it was just A Christmas Carol.
A Christmas Carol.
Yeah. Came out on TV in 1971, won an Oscar in 1972.
Did not know that. Good one.
We've been to the movies with Matt O'Lane.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight, to be and go be three-time Grammy nominees, the Avett Brothers. The Avett Brothers at Red Rocks airs tonight at 7:30 Central, 6:30 Mountain, and then at 9 p.m. Central.
It's the legendary performance.
When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry.
Johnny Cash at the Tennessee State Prison.
Life ain't easy for a boy named Sue.
And he was joined by special guests.
Baby, you're no good.
Roll in my sweet baby's heart.
The television classic. Johnny Cash, a concert behind prison walls.
Johnny Cash, a concert behind prison walls, preceded by the Avett Brothers. Watch it all tonight, beginning at 7:30 Central, 6:30 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 4th. Labor Day traditionally marks the end of summer, and many North Dakota communities observe the federal holiday differently. The holiday falls on the first Monday of September every year. In 1947, the Moorton Community Club began annual Labor Day celebrations with a supper and refreshments on the lawn in front of the old city hall. Over the years, the celebration included baseball tournaments, parades, turkey shoots, and plays. The town's celebration eventually grew to 3 days of festivities. Raffle giveaways were added with prizes such as television sets, automobiles, a boat, motor, and trailer, and trips to Hawaii. In 1984, the Moorton area celebrated the city's centennial on Labor Day weekend. Moorton is in southeastern North Dakota. Reeder's early days included a Labor Day extravaganza in 1908, that had a market auction of livestock, household goods, and farm equipment, and the first performance of the new Reeder Brass Band. Baseball teams of Reeder and Wolf Butte played each other that year, with Reeder winning 6-3. The band's performance was well received, earning the band $125. Admittance was 75 cents for adults and 25 cents for children. Refreshments and dancing ended the day. Readers in southwestern North Dakota. In the nation's bicentennial year of 1976, horseback riding enthusiasts of the Adrian and Montpelier area organized the Valley Rough Riders of 76 and held a horse show on Memorial Day and the Little Rough Riders Rodeo on Labor Day. The event attracted over 1,000 people to Adrian, which is south of Jamestown. The Almont Commercial Club in 1963 held a steam engine threshing day on Labor Day. In 1932, the Sykeston Women's Club planted an elm tree on Labor Day in honor of President Washington. The Ladies' Aid and Lutheran Women's Missionary League of Zion Evangelical Lutheran Church near Binford began baking and selling pies all through the summer of 2003 to raise money for their centennial. They sold 10 to 20 pies a week, but they ramped it up as Labor Day approached, baking 40 pies for sale at the Red Willow Lake Farmers Market. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Jack Dura. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
David Chang made a name for himself as a famous chef, but all the while, he's battled something more formidable than four-star ratings, his own mental health.
My battle with my own self has resulted in a lot of good things and bad things.
Chef David Chang's memoir and the latest in politics and COVID, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Coming up Monday on the show, Main Street is preempted for a Labor Day special. One small step, courageous conversations across a growing divide. It's a collaboration between NPR and StoryCorps that brings people of opposing political views together to talk about their lives, producing some surprising and poignant conversations. That's a Monday on Main Street. Until then, enjoy your holiday weekend.